Well, the first thing is that the folks who organized the Occupy Vancouver action were not activists, or at least known to the activist community, which is a positive thing in the sense that they didn't wait for anybody to give them permission to pick up the ball. They did it, and they should be commended for that. But something else happens when it comes to inexperience. It's like a lot of people are not very politicized. And as you and your listeners might remember, we had anti-Olympic convergence here in 2010. And the main slogan of that convergence was "No Olympics on Stolen Native Land." And I think we did a pretty damn good job at, informing people that, we are settlers in somebody else's land. A lot of these folks who organized Occupy Vancouver were not really clued in. And so there was a bit of a struggle to make them understand that had to be acknowledged. But, that battle has been won. Their website acknowledges that we are indeed in unceded Coast Salish territories. And there's indigenous folks who feel now more comfortable taking part of the encampment. And even if they're not camping, I know a bunch of indigenous folks that are friends of mine who actually feel comfortable just coming there and hanging out. So I think a similar thing happened in Denver, where Denver AIM, as in American Indian Movement, posed a challenge to the organizers of Occupy Denver. And it was approved unanimously that they were going to acknowledge that Denver was indeed also stolen indigenous land. So, I think that in our job as media makers and as activists, sometimes we have to have a lot of patience with folks who are just kind of entering into this arena, And I think that these things, we're just basically chipping away, but it's certainly, it's an uphill battle.
I've dubbed Occupy Brisbane as Occupy Facebook, and there's been a lot of discussion on Facebook, and I think mainly people on Facebook are the ones that have been extremely racist, and I'm interested in knowing if that kind of racism, oh, this is not their land, and those abos, and some really offensive racism that I don't want to repeat, but was that kind of thing happening in Vancouver?
As you know, I don't really engage too much in Facebook. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
So I don't engage in Facebook all that much, but I was in Japan when a lot of these things were going down, and one of the main reasons why I got off of Facebook is because of just this is it becomes a counterproductive forum for trolls to disrupt any sort of constructive discussion. And again, my first experience was this during the Olympics when some folks smashed up some windows of a company that has been around since the colonial times to actually help conquer indigenous lands in BC. Those windows were smashed, and as soon as that happened, people just started just insulting and just being completely, again, counterproductive in the discussion of diversity of tactics. And so that the video from a debate that happened around that time resurfaced again. It's a video I made, and I had called it Occupy Vancouver back then because it referred to a tent city occupation that happened during the Olympics. And so this the racism around the person who was very favorably promoting diversity of tactics. She is from India. And of course, all this racism came through again. And I think Facebook is very easy for people to hide in there. But at the actual occupation camp, since the camp, barely has internet, it's really hard for people who are not there to engage in Facebook. So the people who are engaged on the day to day of the camp don't even have any idea of the battles that rage on Facebook. So it almost becomes irrelevant because people are not really dealing with that. They're actually dealing with the rain. They're dealing with building infrastructure, medical, food, media, direct action committees. And so in a sense, getting off of that Facebook is one of the best things that could have happened to the camp.
I heard an interview that you did with a media group from Canada, about the activism that's happening in Japan.
Yeah, the folks who organized my tour are also extremely involved in the grassroots anti-nuclear movement. And, you know, those folks have really bigger fish to fry than to have to organize a tour for NCIF. But, you know, at the same time, it was a very timely screening. I think if I would have screened this film in January, it would have been a whole completely different reception. You know, but those folks are feeling the effects of industrial civilization in a very real way. You know, nearly a third of the island is irradiated, and the government's not really evacuating people. The government's not really having a stream of information to let people know what to do to be safe. And part of that is because the government there is in collusion with the nuclear industry, and it's not in their best interest to put it out there that, you know, nuclear industry and nuclear energy is actually very dangerous to human beings. So the folks that I met with were mostly anarchists, definitely anti-authoritarian, and definitely anti-capitalist, and the culture of activism in Japan had been mostly been dead for 20 years during the 80s and 90s, and so it sort of had a resurgence, a small resurgence during the run-up to the Iraq War, then with the G20 in 2008. But these folks have been organizing a protest or a mobilization every month since the Fukushima accident. So since, you know, Fukushima happened on 3/11, on March 11th, so on 4/11, 5/11, 6/11, and so on, they've been holding these actions, mostly using sound and being bands or DJs or whatnot. And they were surprised themselves when the first one brought out 15,000 people, and now they've topped out about 20,000 people. And this is something that Japan is not really used to seeing, you know, since the 60s, when they had a pretty massive a protest culture over there.
What was the reaction over there from pacifists? I know that in America you had some interesting reactions from pacifists.
You know, it was interesting too, because I really did not know what that reaction was going to be. And there were certainly discussions about it, but, you know, Japan and I think the Japanese are very well informed about their own history, and so they understand that certain forms of militant actions can be counterproductive, but at the same time they understand when they can be productive. For instance, like back in the 70s, there was a lot of sectarianism within the left, and so some of these groups, which included a Japanese version of the Red Army faction, were committing, you know, acts of terrorism. But they were also killing each other. They were doing like sectarian violence amongst themselves and even within their own groups. And I think that this that division between those groups really turned off people who wanted to be part of like a movement. But also, like, there's been other struggles where people can nod their head and say, like, you know what, force was necessary in those cases. For instance, the expansion of the airport near Tokyo in an area called Chiba by farmers who fought tooth and nail to protect their land. And they did not totally win, but they did not totally lose. You know, as you're flying into Tokyo, you can see that the shape of the airport is actually kind of odd. And it's because these farmers, who were offered much money for their land, refused because they loved that land. And they were actually able to protect huge chunks of it. So they basically, the areas that the airport was able to grab had to work around the farms of those farmers who fought with all their might to stop the construction of the airport. And the same goes for like migrant workers and day laborers in the city of where anytime they get abused by the police, people they riot. You know, to let the police know that they can't be abusing people even though they're poor and disenfranchised. So, with that said, the reaction of the public in Japan was very positive, mostly because they understand that industrial civilization brought them to this point. You know, to this point where people call it the apocalypse, you know, because they've irradiated a massive area of Japan. This is an area that should be evacuated, but it's not, where people are going to be acquiring all sorts of cancers, and new people who are born are going to have all sorts of birth defects. The food, the water, the soil, all of it is contaminated. And so I think that, you know, usually when I do these screenings, I hardly ever sell a lot of DVDs. And every screening that I did, I pretty much sold out of the DVDs that were brought, which is a testament that people really wanted to spread the film. I got a lot of requests from people saying, I want to do screenings in my community. I want to go to other parts of Japan. And so I think that in a weird way, you know, I mean, I didn't really make this film for Japanese people. It kind of worked out.
And it's translated into Japanese or has subtitles?
Yeah, the subtitles are in Japanese, and people can actually watch it in Japanese already on the website, which is ncivcom. That's ENDCIV.com.